which is EEOC versus Target Corporation.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jim Tucker, and I represent Appellant Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I'm here today to ask this court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to Target and remand the case for trial. The commission's appeal concerns two components of the district court's decision: its treatment of the commission's individual disparate treatment claims regarding Kalisha White, Raphael Legiston, Charisse Brown Easley, and James Daniels, Jr., and also its treatment of the commission's record-keeping violation request for injunctive relief. The district court's actions in regard to each of these claims was premised on a failure to acknowledge the genuine dispute over facts which were material to those issues and which made summary judgment inappropriate. Let me begin with the commission's individual claims regarding White, Edgerton, and Brown Easley. The Target offered as its reason for not interviewing these individuals the excuse that Armiger was simply too busy with his management duties to properly perform his recruiting functions. Now, the commission presented ample evidence to create a genuine dispute over this issue.
Well, there were two white males he didn't interview as well, wasn't
it? Well, Your Honor, the commission respectfully submits that for some purposes of summary judgment, the matter is in dispute as to whether or not those two particular individuals were interviewed.
Do you dispute that?
We dispute that by, first of all, the evidence regarding one of them, Scott Poterski, is that he doesn't remember if he was interviewed. And Armiger does not remember if he was interviewed either. There's no affirmative evidence that he was interviewed. That he was not interviewed. And his name is on the interview list. So the only evidence regarding him really is that his name is on the list. So I can't say that, or I don't think it can be properly taken that is affirmatively established in Target's favor on purpose of summary judgment. Now, as for Paul Clement, the other individual, he was not interviewed by Armiger as was scheduled, but he did call back called the same phone number that Edgerton and Brown Easley called, asked about his failure to be interviewed, and was offered an interview immediately.
Does the record tell us anything about who from Target returned Mr. Clement's call and rescheduled his interview?
Other than that it was not Armiger, no, Your Honor. All that's established is that all that the record presents is that Clement called the same phone number that Armiger gave him, which is exactly what Edgerton and Brown Easley did. He mentioned that he had missed his interview and was calling about that, just as Edgerton had done. And instead of getting told that Armiger was too busy or that he'd get a call back, he was given an interview.
Well, so in other words, we will never know at this juncture whether or not the person who did call back was calling at Mr. Armiger's behest.
That's correct. That's not in the record. All that we can infer from the record is that Armiger asserted that he was too busy to interview certain applicants, and viewed properly on summary judgment, the record is sufficient for a reasonable fact finder to conclude in favor of the commission that he was only too busy to interview the African-American candidates.
What, if anything, will the record tell us about the pool of applicants whose resumes Mr. Armiger was given? Do we know anything about the racial makeup of that group, for example?
Other than the fact that they're all Caucasian, no, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. I believe that during discovery, roughly half of the documents pertaining to that interview process weren't disclosed by Target, so they're either destroyed or otherwise not preserved. So it's simply not in the record as to that. All we have in the record is that we know that they were Caucasian via their affidavit statements, and that the people who were not interviewed were African American.
Where did the plaintiffs in this action have their first contact with Target?
I believe that regarding Kalisha White, her first contact with Target was through the prior recruiter before Armiger and Walters took over in District 110. That was with Carrie Espich, and that's who passed on Kalisha White's information to Armiger to schedule an interview. As far as Edgerton and Brown Easley, their resumes were submitted at a multicultural career fair at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and again, recruiters passed that information on to Armiger for him to do follow-up on. As far as James Daniels, I'm not exactly clear as far as what his initial path is as far as his contact with Target, other than it was sufficient for him to submit information that Target considered him qualified enough to offer him an elite interview and to schedule him for their PDI leadership exam. So that's all I have on that particular question, Your Honor. Now, as far as dealing with, again, the specific question of whether or not the commission presented sufficient facts to show that Armiger's excuse of being too busy to interview the African-American candidates was pretext, we showed, for example, the evidence regarding the Sarah Brucker incident with Kalisha White, where Kalisha White, after repeatedly contacting Armiger and repeatedly being told that he was too busy to interview her, submitted an application from a fictitious Caucasian candidate with admittedly and deliberately lesser qualifications than her own, and this individual was able to schedule an interview immediately with Armiger. He took the time to speak with her about or offer information about the job, offer to ask any questions of her. This was 15 minutes.
That's your strongest case. Does that evidence, is that available to the other two women? Is that, is by analogy, do they profit from that experience?
We think that the commission believes that they do, to the point that it's a rebuttal of Armiger's consistent statement that he was simply too busy performing his job functions. That's the same excuse that was given regarding Edgerton and Brown Easley. It's the same excuse he's proffered uniformly.
Let me ask you a global question. Is there anything more important to the EEOC than record retention?
Is there anything more important?
Mm-hmm. How do you go about doing a case if you don't have any records?
It's critically important, but we don't want to overstate the point. There are limitations to what the statute and what the regulations require for retention. But as we began with a pattern of practice case, or initiated a pattern of practice case in this instance, and we weren't able to develop that case, now, largely, we believe, because of the fact that there weren't sufficient records to present that case. Now, again, acknowledging the limitations within the laws that we work under, we can only expect certain things to be retained as a matter of law, but it can definitely create a problem.
I'm confused about this question of what's the standard of review of the injunction, grant or refusal of an injunction.
Okay.
Target is assuming that the standard is abuse of discretion. In your brief, you seem to be saying that a summary judgment with respect to an injunction is different than abuse of discretion. You asked for the injunction, and it was denied, but it seems to me if there's some kind of a summary judgment standard that has to be applied to that, you're in worse shape than you would be if it was just abuse of discretion. So I don't understand your position.
I'm not sure that I necessarily agree that we'd be in a worse case, Your Honor, but I do believe that the correct standard of review is summary judgment de novo review.
What does that mean in context of abuse of discretion?
What that means in this case is that because there were genuine issues of facts material to whether or not injunctive relief was warranted, this court has identified at least three particular factors that need to be addressed by a court when assessing whether injunctive relief is appropriate. That is, the bona fide intention of the employer to presently comply with the law, the character of the past violations, and the present compliance of the employer. And these factors were assessed against the commission on Target's motion for summary judgment. That is, there was evidence putting each of those factors in dispute, and the court did not confer upon the commission the reading of the evidence in the light most favorable to it.
No,
in determining
asked
whether
for the injunction. Target didn't ask for the injunction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Excuse me.
You asked for the injunction. Target didn't ask for the injunction.
That's correct, Your Honor. We asked for the injunction, and Target moved.
If you have to apply a summary judgment standard, then you have to more or less say there wasn't any evidence on the other side. There wasn't any evidence for refusing an injunction, which is a much more difficult standard to meet than abuse of discretion, it seems to me. I just don't understand why you're arguing that.
Well, we simply believe that because the motion was presented on summary judgment, and looking at what the court did.
What good is it, do you, to argue that it's a summary judgment matter, not just a straight request for an injunction?
Well, I don't believe that the law is fully developed, Your Honor, on the question of whether or not if we were to apply an abuse, or if this court was to apply abuse of discretion, it would be in the commission's favor.
What seemed odd to me here is that Judge Randa entered summary judgment in Target's favor on the claim for injunctive relief rather than exercising his discretion to deny that relief, so that his decision really reads more like the EEOC isn't entitled to injunction as a matter of law. I mean, that's a
We're also puzzled with that, with the result in that case, but the key, I guess, issue for our purposes of appeal is that he did what he did, and we have a grant of Target's motion for summary judgment in the case, and we believe that because those factors that I enumerated a moment ago are in genuine dispute, that was inappropriate as a matter of law. He could have exercised his discretion on a fully developed factual record. That's the commission does not contest that. If whether there was a fact-finding hearing, some opportunity the commission had to cross-examine Armiger, Target, of course, would have its opportunity to do so as well regarding other witnesses as to whether or not, for example, there was destruction in bad faith. But because the proper factual record was not developed, we believe that it's inappropriate for this court to exercise an abuse of discretion standard review.
And, of course, bad faith would arguably support injunctive.
I don't understand that.
That's correct, Your
Honor. I don't understand your position. Are you saying that there was, as a matter of law, that an injunction should have been entered?
That would be
a summary judgment standard.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We're not appealing the denial of our motion for summary judgment. This is simply an appeal of the grant of summary judgment to Target. That is, the district court's decision.
Well, they didn't ask for an injunction in their request.
No, but they did ask, Your Honor, to in their motion for summary judgment, that they prevail on our claim for injunctive relief. And that's...
Well,
if they deny your request for if the judge denies your request for injunction,
we were moving for summary judgment, Your Honor, on that point. So if he denied,
how can you have summary judgment on a discretionary point? There is I found a Seventh Circuit case. I haven't got the reference to it right here that talks about this about a summary judgment. It doesn't ever explain what this amounts to, though.
Unfortunately, I didn't make it into my brief, but I did find one unreported decision as well. We may be discussing the same case, Reed versus Richards, which issued by this court in 1994, which applied a summary judgment standard to a review of a denial of injunctive relief on summary judgment, but again, without enunciating why it did so. We would simply submit that because the factual record was inappropriate for summary judgment, that the Target should, at the very least, have not prevailed on that claim. If I could, I'd like to return to speaking a little bit more about our individual claims and the matters that are in dispute regarding those individual claims. Again, I've spoken about the Kalisha White and Sarah Brucker incident, and I want to make sure that I make the point that while there's been some contest alleged by Target regarding the 15-minute time period between when Kalisha White was last told that she was not, that Armiger was too busy to interview her, and the time when he took all his time to speak with the Caucasian Sarah Brucker, that matter is not in dispute. There's no conflict in the record. Kalisha White testified that she didn't remember a year and a half later in her deposition what she'd written specifically in her charge, but she affirmed that her charge was correct as a contemporaneous statement of the time frame. The commission has also presented evidence to dispute Target's assertion that Armiger was not aware of the race of these individuals. The commission believes that there's ample evidence to show that issue is, again, in dispute for purposes of summary judgment, and therefore it should not be granted in Target's favor. The commission presented evidence, for example, regarding the resumes of these individuals. Now, Armiger stated that he reviewed all of these resumes, and he also stated that the kind of things he looks at when he either reviews resumes or is going over a person's qualifications are things such as their extracurricular activities, their college major, whether there's any sorority involvement, and their academic experiences. Now, Kalisha White's resume listed that she was a member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, which Armiger admitted to knowing that was an African-American sorority. Raphael Legiston also listed Alpha Kappa Alpha as part of her, on her resume, as well as the fact that she was a major in African-American studies, that she was a member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which Armiger admitted to knowing was the NAACP, and he admitted that it was obviously an indicator that she, or excuse me, that it could obviously indicate that she was African-American by her mention of her publication of a paper titled The African American Response to School Choice in Milwaukee. Now, as for Cherise Brown Easley's resume, it also listed that she was a member of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Alliance of Black School Educators, and Armiger again admitted that he took the use of the term black in that context to refer to African Americans. Now, beyond these indices of race on their resumes, the commission also presented expert evidence regarding voice and name recognition of African Americans, which again puts further into question whether Armiger was aware of the race of these folks. Our expert evidence regarding voice recognition testified that all three, presented a report, which was uncontested, that all three of our individuals were identifiable as African American by their voices and over the telephone, and there's no question that Armiger spoke with all three over the telephone. There's also evidence that, regarding the name recognition the commission presented, that Armiger was able to identify at least, or let me be more clear, that recruiters are able to identify the race of individuals from their names. And we also submitted evidence regarding the fact that, again, as we've discussed earlier, the documents received by Armiger came from, at least for Edgerton and Brown Easley, from a multicultural career fair. I see that my time is up prior to rebuttal. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
I think the case I was talking about is Crest Hill Land Development versus City of Joliet. Are you acquainted with that one?
I'm not familiar with that, Your Honor. I didn't cross that.
It involves an injunction in the summary judgment motion, but
I'm sorry.
It doesn't explain what it is, but...
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Mr. Lewis.
Good morning. Donald Lewis, Hallam & Snylyn Law Firm, representing Target Corporation. The starting point in any race discrimination case is knowledge by the alleged perpetrator of the discrimination that the applicants are members of a protected class. And there's got to be, in addition to some probative evidence on that point, evidence of intent to discriminate. And that's where the commission's evidence was lacking below. It's very important that we look at these episodes and ask ourselves where is the resume information potentially relevant? Because at some point, the commission's expert testimony regarding name recognition based on resumes is irrelevant, because Matt Armiger, regardless of whether he may or may not have known the race of these individuals, based upon any review of the resume that he made, he granted a callback. He invited them to contact, he sent them an email inviting them to interview with Target Corporation.
This is after he read the resume.
Yes. And in fact, the EEOC's own expert, Marianne Bertrand, who in her own testimony said she couldn't opine as to Matt Armiger's intent, found under her own analysis, she was measuring invitations to call back, and the EEOC's own expert said that if after submitting the resume, the employer invited the applicant for an interview, that, according to their expert, was a successful, non-discriminatory outcome. So if anything, the EEOC's own expert...
That's not an outcome. That's just a step in the
that's
process.
It's a step, but I'm saying according to their expert. That's what their expert testified to. That, in her eyes, was measured as a non-discriminatory act. I only make that point because it's
can't
just...
Can't you have a non-discriminatory act followed by an extraordinarily discriminatory act?
The point I'm making, Your Honor, is the limit of the testimony that they provided. They make the point that Ms. Bertrand's expert report is somehow probative on Matt Armiger's intent when, in fact, it isn't. And that is why Judge Randa below felt that it was just simply unhelpful. And it only applied when you got up to the resume, through the resume portion of the process. Because, for example, when we get to the point where Matt Armiger has scheduled these interviews, let's say for Raphael Edgerton and Cherise Brown, He has already reviewed the resumes perhaps a week before. But based on the information that he has in front of him, there's nothing that Marianne Bertram tells us that is helpful in determining what is in Matt Arminger's mind at the time he, for whatever reason, fails to make the phone calls to Raphael Edgson and Cherise Brown.
I'd like to know what was in Mr. Arminger's mind when the fictitious Miss Brucker got a call back 15 minutes after Mr. Arminger told Miss White he was too busy to schedule an interview. Doesn't that provide really fairly strong support for a disparate treatment theory?
All that evidence shows, first of all, we don't know what was in Mr. Arminger's mind, and that's the problem with the EEOC's position. They have got to proffer some evidence that Mr. Arminger at that point knew the race of these two applicants, and there's no evidence to support that he knew the race of those two applicants. And we've got
well, there's a lot of expert testimony about...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what...
I said there's a lot of expert testimony about recognizing names and recognizing voices and so... I mean, there's evidence. That's evidence. You say it doesn't mean anything, but it's...
It is not. It's not sufficiently probative, Your Honor. Marianne Bertram,
well,
in essence, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Look, couldn't a jury think that when he suddenly had the time to speak with Miss Brucker, he also would have had the time to call Miss White back? I mean, wouldn't it be up to a jury to decide whether, you know, the names, the sorority, the papers that were written, the voice? I mean,
all right. On this evidence, on the record before us, there isn't sufficient evidence upon which the jury to make that decision beyond conjecture. And let me emphasize this point. When the alleged calls are made by Kalisha White and Sarah Brucker, there's no evidence at that moment that Mr. Arminger would have known of the race of those two individuals. Let's take the evidence what is the evidence in the record that somehow Matt Arminger is able to discern the voices of African-American applicants? It's expert testimony from Tom Purnell, who basically testified that he can recognize the voices of African-American applicants, that once knowing the race of the charging parties, he spent 20 minutes apiece talking to these charging parties, asking them to read pre-scripted verses to this expert.
Well, let's put him aside, and let's look at the resumes.
Right.
They both listed their membership in an African-American sorority. They listed African-American studies, well, one of them did, as a major, identifying herself as a member of the NAACP. You'd have to live on Mars not to know what the NAACP is. Mm-hmm. One identified herself as a member of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Alliance of Black School Educators.
Okay.
He saw these resumes before he contacted the plaintiffs. It's a fair inference, isn't it, on summary judgment? We're talking about summary judgment. That he saw these items and he surmised that the three women were African Americans.
The evidence, Your Honor, is that he saw the resumes on April 27th, or thereabouts, based upon the review of the resume of Kalisha White, he decided to invite her for an interview and did so. Now, go forward 10 days to the Sarah Brucker episode. There is no evidence in the record that those resumes at that point had any meaning or relevance, that they were even in front of Mr. Armiger at the time of the phone calls.
That's why you need trials.
But there's, but in order to put a triable issue before the jury, there's got to be something for the jury in order to rest any factual finding on that issue of what Matt Armiger knew, and beyond that, what his intent was.
Should we go on to retaining documents and destroying documents?
Please. All right.
How do we get past that?
All right. The evidence is that in the spring of 2001, Target was in a transition in its recruiting function. It was moving from a district-based recruiting to a centralized recruiting on a regional basis that was run out of Minneapolis. During that interim time period, there were two STLs, including Mr. Armiger, who were responsible for handling the recruiting function. And the evidence shows that Mr. Armiger mishandled about 60 resumes. 60 resumes, throwing away resumes of applicants that he had determined did not meet the minimum qualifications. No evidence at all that he did that because he meant to hide something. No evidence at all that he threw away resumes of black applicants.
Isn't Mr. Waters' evidence? Mr. Waters testified that he had, contrary to Armiger's, Mr. Waters, the co-recruiter, said he told Armiger that they needed to retain resumes.
Mr. Walters, there's no evidence about when that discussion took place.
Well, but is it fair to assume that he did so while Armiger is still interviewing applicants? I mean, why would he tell him after that?
Right. Well, the point is that Mr. Walters is not telling Mr. Armiger anything that isn't, that's consistent with Target policy. We concede that it's Target policy that, consistent with law, you're supposed to retain resumes. We concede that Matt Armiger destroyed some 60 resumes that he should not have destroyed. But it's a pretty long leap to go from those facts to conclude that the district court was somehow required as a matter of law to issue injunctive relief against Target once Target had completed the centralization of its recruiting function, once Target had changed its record retention policy, once Target had strengthened its implementation and policy by training its personnel, once Matt Armiger moved out of the recruiting function, moved out of a Target store to begin with and began working in a distribution center outside of the district, and in the absence of any evidence that whatever Matt Armiger did, he did out of ill will, trying to hide something, out of racial animus, because there's absolutely no evidence that the destruction of the resumes was in any way adversely impacted or were resumes of disproportionately African-American applicants.
Well, in other words, you're saying that the evidence could not ever permit an inference that that Armiger knows he's not supposed to keep the resumes, that he is, rather, supposed to keep the resumes. If you know that you're supposed to keep the resumes, if you've been told you are supposed to keep these resumes, and then you destroy them or you discard them, surely that would arguably support an inference of bad faith, would it not?
No. First of all, all this begs the question as to what adverse inference it supports. If it shows that he simply destroyed a subset of resumes that had no pattern beyond the fact that they were resumes of applicants that he felt were not qualified.
How do we know this? He's destroying all of these resumes. He's destroying resumes. How can we have subsets or sets or anything when the guy is throwing them all away?
He's not throwing them all away, Your Honor. That's not what the evidence shows. The evidence shows that he discarded 60 resumes in his mind because he thought he could. And we concede that he shouldn't have. But then what is the result of that? Is it an injunction? We submit no. Is it an adverse inference? It begs the question of what the adverse inference is. Because you can't push it any further than the fact that perhaps he destroyed resumes of folks who were minimally qualified. But we concede that Kalisha White and Raphael Edgerton, Charisse Braun-Easley at least met the minimum qualification. So the point I'm making is the fact that Mr. Arminger destroyed this small set of resumes doesn't take us to where the EEOC wants us to go. It doesn't take us to an injunction, and it doesn't take us to an adverse inference of racial intent. Again, without significantly probative evidence that Mr. Arminger knew the race, without probative evidence that he intended a racially discriminatory result, with respect to the Kalisha White and the Sarah Brucker episode, all you have to offer the jury is they were treated differently. And that is not enough to support an inference of racial discrimination, certainly not enough to submit the case to the jury. Let me...
unless you have actually been presented in person, you don't have any sufficient evidence to go to a jury, is that?
No, that I don't think that's the point, Your Honor.
Well, what is the point, then?
I mean, I suppose that you could fashion some proper expert testimony where Marianne Bertram is testing names that were at issue in this case. I suppose you could fashion admissible expert testimony where Dr. Purnell is testing voice recognition of these charging parties in circumstances that replicate the circumstance that Matt Arminger was presented with. Tom Purnell knew the race of these individuals before he talked to them on the phone for 20 minutes based on a script that he provided. There was not the distraction of the environment of a store. There was not, Matt Arminger, any conversation he had with these individuals was a conversation that was designed solely to set up an interview and could have lasted no more than 60 seconds. That's the record that you have in front of you. Yes, you can fashion some expert testimony that would be probative on this point, but the issue, the record that the EEOC had fashioned here was wholly inadequate, and Judge Randa was well within his discretion to conclude that it was just simply not
helpful.
What
you said is all cross-examination, though, isn't it? I mean, you're offering reasons why the evidence isn't very probative, but...
Point you're making is I'm making a good closing argument, but I think what I'm also saying, Your Honor, is I'm making a good gatekeeping argument as well, because that is the district judge has to, even on summary judgment, assess the relevance and helpfulness and probativeness of testimony that's being offered to support even the minimal factual inferences that could survive a summary judgment motion.
You know, Judge Randa based a lot of his decision on his view that Target had beefed up its effort to retain to ensure compliance with with its record mm-hmm. retention policy, and I don't want to upset you, but I have a problem with that too, because Brass Ring, which has been retained to gather and retain documents, it's all going to depend on Target employees to forward the documents for retention. So I'm not, I'm not sure that that's so helpful here.
That there's no other way you can retain records but through human beings, John.
Well, no one was disciplined for failing to comply with the policy. That would be, a good way to make people know you really mean business.
It's probably up to Target to make these decisions about what is the best system to keep its records in accordance with law. They had decided, given the shortcomings that had existed before, to use Brass Ring, to engage in increased training, to have multiple points where records could be kept. Perhaps it's not 100% foolproof, but it's certainly a mechanism that complies with Title VII. And the facts on this record, the facts of an attempt to comply, no likelihood of a significant likelihood of recurrence, and absence of bad faith, certainly supports a district court decision not to issue injunctive relief in the case.
Thank you.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Tucker, how much time? You have 4 minutes, Mr.
4 minutes,
Tucker.
Thank you. The key point I'd like to make in response is simply that what we're talking about, again, is summary judgment. Now, not to beg too much the question as to which standard of review we need to apply regarding the record-keeping issue, but what we're talking about is a record wherein there is evidence that Target's remedial practices weren't sufficient, not merely with the Brass Ring problems with documents supposedly going all to one place, but then, of course, the testimony of the record keeper in District 110 showing the documents, some go to her, some go to Brass Ring, which doesn't itself imply a violation, but it implies a little bit of chaos, perhaps, followed up with the problem identified by Target's own expert that the document retention via Brass Ring results in almost unintelligible records. You can't tell where somebody applied. You can't tell what job they applied for. There is sufficient evidence in the record for there to be a genuine dispute as to whether or not the record keeping was appropriate or whether or not the injunctive relief would have been appropriate. Target's assertion is simply, or it seems like it's tending towards, an argument that what we really need to present in order to prevail in any kind of discrimination claim is direct evidence of intent, direct evidence of knowledge, direct evidence all the way through, and that's simply not the standard, particularly for purposes of summary judgment. All the commission needs to do is present sufficient evidence, circumstantial evidence, that creates a genuine dispute over material facts. I think I'll make no further comments. Thank you, Your Honors. We respectfully request that you reverse and remand.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move for the third case for today, United States versus Peters.